Yes, I'm Matthew Sweet.
You are. You look exactly like him.
And him. And the other guy.
All the versions thereof. That album that I've got in my hands, Inside, came out in 1986, according to the copyright on there. When you were recording that album, did you ever think you'd be still at this thing 20, whatever this thing is, 22 years later?
You know, I think it was so inconceivable to me to even think of myself as, I just didn't even think of myself as an artist really then, you know, so I kind of didn't think, how long will I go or not? It was so new, you know? So no, I guess I didn't really think that. It's kind of amazing how it just happens and you don't have to do anything. You know what I mean? Time just moves forward and suddenly it's been so long, you know?
20, it blows me away. Now, Athens was an interesting place back then. For example, there was this band that I kind of didn't know that much about, and my audience probably doesn't either, called the Community Trolls.
Well, Community Trolls was a name that Peter Buck used when they did these kind of shows, just sort of, he would jam with different people from Athens bands. But we sort of co-opted it for this thing Michael Stipe and I did together, which was, you know, it was just fun making up songs and kind of, you know, it we didn't know it had such a huge future, I guess, but it took a long time for that stuff to show up in the world, sort of. But when I was first in Athens, I was making four tracks in my room and everything, and I was kind of learning how to write songs. And, you know, sometimes I'd help. Like, I remember Michael wanted to learn some the chords to some Velvet Underground song, so he came over and had me learn it off the record, you know. I mean, you couldn't go online and get the chords to anything, you know.
Yeah, but it was a different world back then, because, you know, especially where you were, there was this hotbed of musicians that nobody really knew back then what it was going to become.
Well, it was a really cool place, and they'd had the B-52s, who were super great, you know, and at the time, other really great groups like Pylon and Love Tractor and all these people, and so it was a cool place because people tried to make up their own kind of music, you know. They'd seen the B-52s have this radical certain kind of thing they did, and I think that was really good for the area because lots of the musicians really tried to do something original, you know. And that attracted me a lot to Athens, that people were making records where they tried to write songs and everything, you know.
Songs. Wait. Songs? Remember songs? I remember those. There were those things called songs.
We call them songs still.
Yeah. Well, you do.
Loosely.
So then 90, you joined with Richard, Robert, Greg, Lloyd, and Fred. And at that moment, things really suddenly took off. That was kind of a trajectory that kind of a little rocket that took off at that exact moment, pretty much.
Well, it took a little longer than that because, like, for instance, on my second record, Earth, which was before we did Girlfriend, and it must have been 88, 9, Richard Lloyd played on that record. So I was kind of getting some of the people in. I think Quine even played on it. And but when we did Girlfriend, it was almost the opposite. We had no pressure, really. I had no concept of it was supposed to be saleable or anything like that. And in fact, my A&R guy left while I was making the record, because A&M was bought by PolyGram. It was kind of the beginning of the everything merging, you know. And so I was kind of left at the label, and we eventually sold Girlfriend from A&M to Zoo Entertainment, kind of a startup on BMG, for like $10,000, which was much less than it cost to make it at the time. And eventually they had to pay that back. So it was kind of a slow time coming. I thought it may never come out for a while, you know.
I did a little research, and Girlfriend hit number 4 on the modern rock charts. Ugly Truth hit number 3.
Really? Wow.
Yes, true fact. I went to the Billboard books and checked
this. Wow.
Okay, Sick of Myself hit number 58 on the Billboard Hot 100. I don't know, which is incredible. But things were different back then in terms of what became a hit. It was so much more of a vibrant top 40 mix than what we have today, where things like Sick of Myself could make it to number 58 on the charts, but it would also still be next to a Motown groove or next to a punk thing or next to, you know, it was top 40. It was a very different world. And as was modern rock or alternative back then, it was much more vibrant and funky and interesting.
Yes, I mean, what sort of happened around that time we made Girlfriend is the college radio sort of charts started to cross over into what they became called alternative rock radio. And that didn't quite exist. It was just sort of starting up then. And it, there was kind of a cool time because there were lots of different kinds of things. And there was a feeling that new kinds of things could make it, sort of, you know. So I think you're right. It was sort of a vibrant time. And what happened is, as the 90s went on, even what had been alternative rock stations became extremely narrow, like what they would play. It just all became kind of more and more corporate, you know.
Yeah, and continues to this day. And then there's some of us that are still getting away with murder, thank goodness. There's just a few of us, you and me both. Now, I want to skip into time and really get into today, because, you know, you interviewed about your history so much, and, you know, girlfriend, and was that the only, nobody, you know what, people can read that. But the first time that we got together, which was a few years ago, I think was unique for you, because the Thorns made only one record. It took 2 years after you made the record, even with that supergroup, in quotes, to come out. But that was the first time that you ever really recorded, Matthew Sweet recorded as part of a band, isn't that true?
That's very true. It's funny, we're playing this club tonight in San Francisco, and the backstage manager was telling me, oh yeah, Sean Mullins was just here, you know? And we were sort of reminiscing about the Thorns thing. But yeah, it was a really difficult thing to do for me in particular. I think really for anybody who's been a solo artist, it's hard to instantly figure out the lay of the land of how you kind of work with three people. And I think for me, I was the most afraid about it because I just had done the least collaboration, I think, of all of us. In the end, though, it was kind of funny because those guys were sort of mad about sort of the way it went and everything. And by the end, I was kind of like, I was cool with it all. So it was a weird sort of trajectory of when who was most into being in the group. But we sold a lot of records, like compared to now,
like 300,000,
not that much, but I think, you know, 175 or 80 or something. And that now, I mean, God, we'd be number one or something, you know?
Yeah. Well, we're going to get to that. Cause I happen to know, I asked today how many records you've sold to the new one, and I know, and it's pretty interesting.
Oh, don't talk about
that. No, it's impressive. So the last time, as I mentioned, we talked was with Ms. Hoffs or Susie and yes. Sid and Susie. And I heard through the grapevine that you have enough songs already for Under the Covers 2, 3, and 4. So maybe a double album this time?
Well, we have enough for a double album. It's we've recorded something like 40 songs. And, you know, we've talked about it being a double album a lot along the way. Although I'm kind of getting the vibe that means like 22 songs or something, you know? So we are going to have to make a lot of decisions, but we've recorded a ton of stuff.
You have extras for you can always do the DVD and do the extras for the DVD.
We have loads of extras for whatever, you know, and there are a lot of places to put bonus tracks and things these days and in other countries too. So, yeah, and we, you know, Susie and I sang on Lucinda Williams' new record, and in fact, we're going to appear in Los Angeles tomorrow night with Lucinda to sing backups on something, so... it's even branched out a little beyond just the two of us. It's really a fun thing because we're friends and it's just so a for fun kind of thing, you know?
Well, I hold you totally responsible for my listeners discovering that Marmalade actually has one more song than Reflections of My Life.
I really like Reflections of My Life. I never really knew that song, so I discovered it, you know, later on.
Yeah, I went after I was playing Under the Covers, I went and got a British import of Best of the Marmalade, yeah. And there's like a zillion, they covered amazing things.
They had some cool covers, and they had some funny, kind of weird songs, you know, like, there's one I remember called Mr. Lion that's like really crazy and funny, it's kind of like talking to the lion, you know, in the song, and that's just the kind of thing I would like, you know.
And now you're also working on Susanna's solo record too, right? So tell me, without giving away any big secrets... It's going to be kind of a different album for her, isn't it? Unexpected, I would imagine.
Well, I think it's going to be more a folky kind of record for her, more of an acoustic folky kind of thing, and a little bit interesting in that way. I'm not sure there will be a ton of drums on it or anything. One of the things I was really into of Susanna's early on, she was on a compilation from Los Angeles during the Paisley Underground, quote-unquote, called Rainy Day, I think, and it was with David Roback, who was her boyfriend from the Rain Parade, is that it? I'm not sure, maybe that was what that album was called, but Susie sang a couple covers on it. One, I think, was a Velvet Underground song, and the other one was a Dylan song called I'll Keep It With Mine. And I really liked her voice with the acoustic guitar and that sound, you know. And so when we were first going to work together, I brought up that record. And I think she's just really natural in that kind of folksy area. And she, it's different for her a little bit. Most of her solo records are more like going after song, radio song kind of things. And so it's a chance for her to be a little more in the woods, you know.
Oh, it's going to be fun. So, Sunshine Lies, you have a long time relationship with the other musicians on the record, which means two things. I think it means a comfort factor, but it also guarantees that the record rocks at the level you want it to rock, right?
Well, it can, yes. And different people turn out being the most rockin'. Like on this record, I think Richard Lloyd did a lot of stuff, and he's got some cool things on it. But somehow Ivan Julian ended up with some of the most crazy rock moments on it as well. So that was a lot of fun to have Ivan, who we used to play live with a lot and hang out. But it was kind of like the record started out as only rock, and then I sort of over time did a few more different kinds of things and added them in before I put it out.
Yeah, and even though you had all those musicians, you still pretty much can play and did play to a certain extent every instrument except for drums, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I played, yeah, there's some songs probably are just Rick and I, Rick Mank playing drums. But it's just very whoever's around, whatever's going on at the moment. You know, my friend Greg Lease also is, you know, indispensable. The problem with the New York rockers is they all live in New York. So Greg's the only one that actually lives in L.A. So I have to figure out how to get him out, you know, when we record. But
yeah, and this wasn't an instantaneous record, because you kind of, what I read was that you conceived it between both the promo stuff you were doing for the Sid and Susie record and doing the bridges.
Yeah, I had probably started it when we were working on that first Sid and Susie stuff, or near after. And then the bridges were, you know, a thing that was over the course of a couple of years. We did some demos, and they got signed to Capitol, and then Capitol folded like 3 days later. And so then we did some more demos, and they finally made their record for Verve. And so we really did that during last year. So I was kind of trying to finish my record, do the Bridges album, and then also we were working on stuff for the 70s record, you know, all along the way. So it's great for me because I love to work in the studio at home, and there was just, you know, an endless amount of things to work on.
But that must have been very fulfilling, because this was your first real solo, I have control over it, in a good way, of course, record in a long time. And it does show in the music, the energy in the music. You know, and, you know, it's easy for reviewers to hearken it back to certain things, and I don't think of it that way. I just think it's a progression of what you like to do, and it's kind of the next phase.
Oh, that's cool of you to say. Well, I think that seeing the fans, and we actually went out and toured for the first time. It's really been like 4 years since we toured at any, you know, we did some Sid and Susie stuff, but not really touring. And so we didn't know what to expect when we went out with my band. And we were really surprised how many fans came out and really cared about it. And especially at this crazy time when everything's kind of caving in. And so that's kind of heartening. It seems like people really like the record. And I think it's because of what you said, there's sort of a feeling in it. Like, and we tried to get that feeling of something into it a little bit by not really working on stuff too much, having it be sort of really fresh. But I do feel like it's the first time I made a solo record that I really thought sounded cool and was pretty together on my own. I mean, we made Kimigaski Raifu, I made for Japan in 2001, and that was probably the first record I made myself on Pro Tools at home. But after that, our systems got much better, and I've learned so much more about engineering. So I think I'm a little more together on, it's not that complex a record, but I'm learning more and more how to kind of get sounds.
Yeah, it was funny because I was playing the Japan record one night, and a listener called me up and they said, guess what? It's available on iTunes now. And I said, and I immediately went on the computer. I was like, whoa, it's about time.
Yeah, well, we had rights after 2 years to put it out in the rest of the world. And in fact, when I last toured, so when we got done with the Thorns, I went out and I just independently put out Kimmy in the U.S. and over in Europe. We went and toured Spain, and also a record called Living Things, which was really a sort of bunch of stuff I was doing right when we were writing the Thorns record. So, but it didn't feel like it was a big effort record, kind of. And in the meantime, I met the people at Shout, and it went so well with the first Sid and Susie, because it's like we sold enough in their model to make another record. Like, they picked up our options. So I was, you know, secretly going, God, I wish I could get them to put my record out. So it's turned out wonderful, and they did a really good job.
Yeah, tell me, just clue me in on a couple of your favorite tracks on the new record and what they're about, what they mean to you.
Wow. Well, that's a hard question. Let me think. Flying came to mind. It's based on this kind of intense riff thing, and we've noticed, like, it really goes over live super well, and it's a thing about, you know, you're out of your element and kind of going crazy, and you're kind of shocked by what's happening and what you're doing. It's sort of an out-of-body experience a little bit, and that song is just cool to me. You know, it's called Flying, but I never thought of it being about flying per se, like on planes, which I am famous for having terrible fear of flying. I went 7 years not flying in the 90s, although I fly now all the time. But it just, it has this sort of unhinged quality that I really like. Let's see, other songs. I really like Time Machine that opens the record, because it's the idea of going into the future, I just think is really sort of cool. And it's not how I think of the Time Machine, but in the actual book, which I like a lot, he does go further and further into the future till it's so weird, like what's going on. It's nothing like now. And I've always liked that view of nature and time, and that makes us entirely insignificant, because it's just a cool feeling, sort of, to think, you know, all you are is part of nature, and you can kind of just roll along with it.
So people, you know, when you read the reviews, they do go out of their way to compare this record to Girlfriend. And what's interesting to me is I came up with a whole new way of thinking about it. Okay. Back when you did Girlfriend, you were not under any pressure to sell a million records.
That's true.
And now you've done Sunshine Lies, and you're not under any pressure to sell a million records.
That's true. And there is it's a hard thing to explain, and we get on this in interviews a lot, that nobody ever made me change what I did, you know, but there was this implied bummer about, like, everything the artists wanted, you know. If the labels, when I was successful, could have had their way, it would just be a picture of you with a guitar on the front, and, you know, you'd write whatever hit they thought would, like, be on the radio. And so I only just did what I did, but there's that weirdness of it, kind of, that pressure is there, and it makes it just a little bit less fun. I mean, for me, it did. I think when I made Altered Beast, that hadn't sunk in. I just thought, whatever I do will be fine, you know, for a minute. But
then that was the moment that somebody said something about it.
Yeah, then it was like Altered Beast was somehow not as good as Girlfriend and kind of weird, and it really just wasn't as commercial, although amazing. It probably did really well compared to how records sell now, you know. That is a weird thing, and I think it's something I've really gotten away from now. Like, the world has changed so much, and the world of labels, I mean, you know, toward the end of the 90s, it was like I could go and sign with some big label, but they want me to, like, you know, use loops or something. You know, it's just like there's always some awful sort of pressure around that made me not even want to be part of it. And in fact, I really didn't look for record deals very much between kind of as I got into the late 90s and into the early century. I was kind of waiting for it to change, and it kind of didn't, you know.
Well, without telling you any numbers, because I don't want to spoil the fun we're having, but I talked to Shout Factory today, and I said, just out of curiosity, tell me something. And this is what they told me. They said that there's the mix of what's selling is wild, that the CD is selling, but the vinyl is selling really, really well. Now, that could be due to the fact that there's extra songs on there. But they turned to me, and again, I'm not going to name the number to you, but even I, because I know a few artists I've interviewed that have had records out for a year that have not sold what this is sold already in this day and age. So it's actually pretty...
I can ask you all about it.
It's pretty important. No, but I mean, all kidding aside, the world that you and I are a few years apart, I'm a little bit older than you, but not by that much. But, you know, when we grew up, you know, a gold record was a gold record, and people had them all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and then it went to, well, okay, now you're selling a lot of downloads, and now it's just funky and weird because big artists, big established artists are not selling a lot of records. And yet, you know, and it's not because we have all these other Web 2.0 things, but it's just kind of strange when you think about it. So the barometer has to be different. It's more has to be more about performance and people just coming out to see the music. I think that becomes almost more important than buying the record these days.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's interesting. And, you know, the vinyl, like you said, it just looks so cool. Like any of us that remember vinyl, you see it and it's like even bigger than you remember it, kind of, you know. The artwork looks really crazy and cool. And since I
And it's coming back, by the way. They're starting to sell a lot of vinyl.
They are. I mean, I think relatively the numbers, you know, aren't that big. But when you buy the vinyl, you get a CD anyway. So it's kind of a no-lose situation.
Exactly.
You get big artwork and a little CD if you want. Yeah.
So being the music and sound person, and I don't want to say geek that we are, have you ever thought about doing what Jerry Harrison did with the Talking Heads albums, maybe going back to the old ones and if you listen to Girlfriend now, and even though they've sort of remastered and stuff, is there stuff, if you had your way, would you go back in? Because he went back into his studio, and he and I have talked about this recently. He took all the Heads albums and put them in 5.1 surround, because he's such a geek. But
well, you know, we've almost done that. Fred Marr, for quite a while, worked for a 5.1 company. Like, I can't remember what the real name is for it, but... We talked a lot about making a 5.1 of Girlfriend, which I guess would be pretty fun. There's not much on it, so there's not a ton to put all over the place. But, you know, I never have really ended up doing that kind of thing. I don't go back and look at what it was very much, you know. It's kind of like going and looking at my baby photos or whatever.
Okay, I have to go here because I read this today and I didn't realize this because when I was in getting my daughter a Wii game the other day, and I noticed that the kids are there and they're playing Spirit in the Sky by Norman Greenbaum, which really scared me because I realized it was not the original. And then I read this morning about Girlfriend on Guitar Hero and I said, whoa, that's really weird.
I thought it was me, you know, when I heard it.
Yeah, because they get so close. But isn't there like one band or something that does them all?
Like there was a lawsuit. The Romantics started a lawsuit. And everybody was going to get on it. And then they lost in Michigan their suit. And it's like...
It's kind of like a bar mitzvah band doing your songs.
It's like no one wants to take on the lawsuit. I guess their argument, it's the biggest selling video game of all time. So you're supposed to just be happy to have the... promotion or whatever.
If anybody knew where to go to get Girlfriend by Matthew Sweet, right?
Exactly. So it does make a new bunch of kids that like know the song at least. But I was at a party and my friend's son played it for us, you know, in front of a bunch of people. And I'm like, that's me. And they're like, no, it's not. And it was like this weird thing. And then I saw the Romantics thing on CNN and I was like, hey. So we looked into it. And in fact, it's one band did all the bands on it. It's mind-blowing because they sound so alike. And
they're obviously good.
All these people wanted to get on it, like, you know, Lynyrd Skynyrd and, you know, 38 Special and whatever bands.
It becomes a cachet, but it can also be a negative cachet, right?
I don't know. I think it's good, in today's world, like we're talking about, anything that might lead to, because we don't need giant numbers to make it work if we can just get a loyal, small fan base, you know?
So, to kind of close it for a second, so we got Sid and Susie, we've got Susan's solo record, we've got a follow-up to Sunshine Lies, I heard a rumor about a possible Velvet Crush record.
They should be doing a Velvet Crush record, we're trying to get them to.
So, I mean, the stars are aligned pretty good at this moment in time, and I know that you've you know, like many of us, you've seen lots of roller coaster level ups and downs, but... You know, what do you want to add to the pile? Perhaps go in the John Bryan route and do a movie soundtrack, perhaps?
I don't know. You know, the problem with movie soundtracks, and in fact, Susie and I went and had a meeting about scoring movies, and the first thing the guy with an agent at CAA, and he was a friend of hers, and he said, you know, forget about doing anything you want to do if you want to do this. And that is kind of one big drawback. It's like they don't really want you to be creative, even if they say. They want you to just do what one of the 50 people thinks, you know, once they hear something. So maybe not that fun. I think if I can be in my studio and making records of mine and doing a few side things, that just sounds more fun to me. But I'll try anything, you know. Anything that sounds remotely interesting, I'll usually say, yeah, I'll give that a shot.